From Oregon to Florida, New Mexico to New York, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, hundreds of thousands rallied at the nation's capital this past week in support of Israel. Matt Brooks from the Republican Jewish Coalition is here to discuss the importance of the event. Once again, Congress has kicked the budget can down the road, this time until after the first of the year. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. And Americans continue to vote with their feet, moving from high-tax states to low-tax states. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Andrew Wolford of the National Taxpayers Foundation. And after the third Republican presidential debate, Nikki Haley has emerged in a strong position. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. As Israel continues its fight against the Hamas terrorists, hundreds of thousands marched in a rally at the nation's capital in support of the Jewish state. Matt Brooks is CEO of the Republican Jewish Coalition, and he is here to talk about the event and recent developments in the war. Matt, welcome to American Radio Journal. Matt, this past week, there was a large rally in Washington, D.C. for a march to support Israel. Why was it so important for that march to take place, especially when it comes to informing public opinion on the current battle that Israel has with the terrorists from Hamas?
Well, Loman, first of all, thanks for having me on the program today. It comes at an incredibly important time, I think, for us as Americans, but also for people who care deeply about Israel and the U.S.-Israel relationship. You're exactly correct. Last week, there was a huge march. In fact, the original plans were for about 60,000 people to come to D.C., and the official estimates following the event pegged the number at 290,000 attendees. It was the largest gathering of American Jews and pro-Israel activists ever in history. So we were thrilled to be part of that effort. We had members from our organization, the Republican Jewish Coalition, fly in from across the country. And to see such an incredible show of support, to have people gather in solidarity with Israel at this time was, I think, important on several levels. First of all, it was an important message to send to our friends and family, people we care deeply about in Israel, that America is standing shoulder to shoulder with them at this difficult time. And that was echoed repeatedly by all of the speakers. The speakers in the program were bipartisan. This was not a event about politics, but it was an event about unity and solidarity. And I think for the people of Israel to see close to 300,000 Americans show up on the mall in Washington, D.C., I'm sure made them feel that they were not alone. And then the other message was to be sent to our community to help in the healing process. The community, because of all the rise in anti-Semitism that we're seeing now, because of all of the fractured and emotions, the difficult time that so many people are experiencing with friends and loved ones in Israel, people who know people who are being held hostage or have been killed in some of the attacks. This was a day of healing for everybody to come together and share in the event and hopefully heal some of the wounds that everybody is dealing with right now. And then the other message was a clear signal to Hamas that their days are numbered and that there is strong bipartisan support in the United States, not just to stand with Israel, but to give Israel the latitude to do what it needs to do to eradicate Hamas once and for all.
Talk a little bit about Hamas here, Matt, because there's a lot of disinformation, much of it spread through college campuses, regrettably. What exactly is Hamas, and why is it important for Israel to eradicate that force?
You know, when you think of Hamas, think of the Nazis in Germany. The mission of Hamas is the same mission that the Nazis had, which is the eradication of the Jewish state and death to all of the Jewish people and, quite frankly, death to America. When they rally and burn Israeli flags, they're also burning American flags, and they shout death to Israel, death to America. They are a terrorist organization whose barbarism was in plain view for everybody to see on the attacks of October 27th, the raping of young children and old women and the taking of hostages, 240 from 30 different nationalities are still being held to this day. The brutal execution and killing of over 1,400 Israelis on October 7th. And to put that in perspective, Loman, based on the population size of Israel versus the United States, that's the equivalent of over 40,000 Americans being killed in one day in one event in the United States. So you can see how horrific the attacks were. And you can't call out Hamas without also calling out Iran, which basically funds them and pulls the puppet strings. There is no doubt that Hamas and Hezbollah, based in Lebanon in the north of Israel, are Iranian proxies. And if you synthesize all of this down, at the end of the day, it all comes back to Iran. But Hamas needs to be eradicated once and for all. And we have not seen this kind of death and killing of Jews since the Holocaust. And that's why everybody is so focused on dealing with this issue.
Matt, it is deeply disturbing, and a lot of this coming from college campuses again, and certainly from the American left, that they're drawing somewhat of a moral equivalency between Hamas and Israel. And this is, first of all, baffling, but how do we begin to combat that sort of thought?
First of all, I think events like the rally that was recently held in Washington go a long way to getting the information out. Part of that also is what we're doing in the Republican Jewish Coalition with our friends in Congress, people who are influencers, people who, when they speak, people listen. It's all about public relations and education. And you're exactly right, Loman, that the college campuses in particular are a cesspool of misinformation and disinformation. And in some ways, so is the media as well. So it's incumbent upon us to work extra hard to get out the narrative. And the press has been reporting recently in the last week or so about the quote-unquote atrocities of the Israelis attacking a hospital in Gaza. Well, as it turns out, all of the intelligence that has come out has shown that Hamas is operating a command center within that hospital. That's what they do. When the press and the college students and everybody wants to rail against the Israelis for attacking population centers and civilian areas and hospitals, they do it not because they want to inflict maximum pain on the people of Gaza. They do it because the barbaric nature of the Hamas leadership has decided that they want to use their citizens as human shields and integrate all of their military operation and their command and control and all of the infrastructure of Hamas in civilian areas and put their own people in harm's way. And that says a lot about who they are. And it underscores, again, the message that needs to come out. I suspect a lot of your listeners didn't know the fact that they, you know, I'm sure many of them have seen the press stories about the attacks in and around the hospital. But they also don't know that Israel has been working to try and evacuate and help move the patients out of there. They have provided incubators and fuel, all of which have been rejected by Hamas, and so that they can try and score public relations points in the narrative. And so it's incumbent upon us to work and to be extraordinarily vigilant in pushing back on these stories and helping to educate the American people and listeners like yours as to what the reality on the ground is.
We have been talking with Matt Brooks, who is the Chief Executive Officer of the Republican Jewish Coalition. Matt, tell us a bit about the Republican Jewish Coalition. Also, give us a website where folks can learn more.
Well, we are a national grassroots of Jewish Republicans, but we also have folks involved with us who are not Jewish. And basically, we are a bridge between the American Jewish community and the Republican Party on issues of concerns. And if any of your listeners want to get involved, we'd love to have them involved. They can find us at rjchq.org. Again, it's rjchq.org, and they can find us on Twitter at rjc.
Matt Brooks of the Republican Jewish Coalition. Matt, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Loman.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth, where once again the can has been kicked down the road on the budget, the federal budget. We're going to talk about that. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be back, Loman. Thank you.
So there's another CR, but this one's a little bit different than what we've seen in past years, Scott. Want to explain what has happened here?
Yeah, well, there was this idea that was proposed just a couple weeks ago to do what was known as a ladder CR. And it would be to have various parts of the federal government not expire all at once, but to sort of split it up. And so what they did was they separated a few of the subcommittees on appropriations and made that expire on one date in January. And then the other part of the bill is going to expire in February. Nonetheless, this continuing resolution funds government at the Pelosi-Biden omnibus levels from last year. And for a lot of conservatives, they weren't very happy with that. Earlier this summer, we had the Fiscal Responsibility Act, and that bill set new statutory spending limits. In this CR, they ignored all of that. They're just continuing, like you said, to kick the can down the road on top of our $33 trillion of national debt and on top of our trillion-dollar annual deficits. So when the House of Representatives pulled that vote up, what we actually ended up seeing was really a big, big split within the House Republican Conference. I think 92 House Republicans voted no. And that's a big signal for Speaker Johnson, the new Speaker, Mike Johnson, and how he's going to resolve differences with his own conference. When you have to rely on mostly Democrats to pass an agenda, that's a problem. And obviously, this is a problem that Mike Johnson inherited. He didn't create it out of thin air, but it does, I think, show a pretty big split here for the Republicans, especially as it pertains to our federal debt and deficit situation. The bill then went over to the United States Senate this week. And there, I think that there were only 11 U.S. senators that voted no. Some senators didn't like the idea of pushing things into January and February. If there's anything good that this bill does, it does avoid the Christmas omnibus fight and really the shutdown politics that usually come alongside that, which usually bring in more of like what I call the Christmas tree packages, right? Whether or not they're going to include the extension of this bill or that bill. Well, the CR did include a little bit less than a year of an extension for the farm bill that will now expire on September 30th of 2024. And then there were a couple other really small provisions that were tucked in there. But generally, this is a bill that avoids a Christmas omnibus, even though it continues spending at the Pelosi-Biden levels from last year.
So Speaker Johnson, as you pointed out here, Scott, did have to depend on Democrat votes to get this. That's what triggered the ouster of the former House Speaker, Kevin McCarthy. Does this put Speaker Johnson on tenterhooks as well?
Some people are calling it strike one or strike two. I think the reality is that Kevin McCarthy made a deal with House conservatives last January that was supposed to provide for new process and transformational reforms to fix the House of Representatives. There was a lot of trust that was built up over the first 5 months. And then when he broke that trust by cutting the deal with Joe Biden on the debt limit increase, that was a big problem for House conservatives. So McCarthy said, oh, I'll work with you all summer on appropriation bills. They didn't get any of them done. And then it, you know, pushed into September, and he basically threw his hands up and said, well, I'm not going to shut down the government. I'm going to call your bluff, and I'm going to go ahead and pass this bill with Democrats. And as soon as he called the bluff, they showed their cards and they did the motion to vacate. And ultimately, 8 House Republicans joined with the Democrats to kick Kevin McCarthy out of the Speaker's office. You know, that led to this big process of Mike Johnson. I do think Mike Johnson is the kind of leader that is acceptable to everybody. They understand the mess that he inherited. And I think that he's going to get the benefit of the doubt, as long as he doesn't break the overall trust levels that he needs to have, whether he's dealing with the far right of the conference or these so-called majority makers that are worried about their own reelections.
So when we hit January and February, and as you pointed out, the benefit here is at least all this isn't going to be playing out against the pressure of the last week before Christmas. But when we hit January and February, the same problems are still there. Can we expect any movement toward resolution, even at that point in time?
Well, I think you'll see the House continue over the next couple of months to try to do more appropriation bills. This week, they again had to pull one of the bills off the floor after the procedural vote, what's known as the rule vote, failed. But they're going to continue to work at it. And I think that a lot of people in Washington are sort of used to taking the easy way out, but we know that making sausage is kind of ugly, and that's usually what legislating is. There's give and take. I think most people are willing to step up and have a real negotiation, but there's going to be red lines for the conservatives.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth has been keeping an eye on this federal budget process, obviously going to be ongoing, and he'll be back again. Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
Yeah, Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. Our members, 525,000 of them from all 50 states, are united in this idea of economic freedom, liberty, and opportunity. Check us out at clubforgrowth.org. Sign up and become a member for free. And also visit us on Twitter at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Thank you, Scott. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you.
Low-tax states continue to gain population while folks are leaving states with higher tax rates. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine discusses the trend with Andrew Wolford of the National Taxpayers Foundation.
You know, since the COVID-19 pandemic hit, more and more workers, especially those of us who are lucky enough to have jobs that we can do from just about anywhere, have taken advantage of that flexibility and have moved around the country, sometimes moved across state lines. We're starting to get a sense of where that movement is happening and what that means for policy going forward. And that's what we're going to take a look at today, because this is a trend that seems like it's only going to continue. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Andrew Wolford. He is the Interstate Commerce Initiative Director at the National Taxpayers Union Foundation. Friend of the show. He's been here before, actually, to talk about a similar topic, and we welcome him back to talk about this new report that NTU has just put out. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me back on, Eric.
This is an interesting new study that you guys have published here, looking at IRS data from 2020 to 2021, so that first year of the pandemic, kind of where people moved around when suddenly going to the office every day didn't matter so much.
Just to clarify, this is data on returns filed in 2020 and 2021. So it's really covering where people were in 2019 versus where they were in 2020. So this is really the first year of the pandemic that we get to look at. And it shows some pretty stark increases in trends we'd already seen. Probably no surprise that taxpayers tend to move from states that have high taxes to states that have lower taxes. But those trends have really accelerated over the last year of data that we have to work with, which is that first year of the pandemic.
Yeah, obviously this is somewhat limited because there have been a few years since then. Maybe some of this has reversed or changed, but I'm looking at the map in the report here, and folks who are listening, this is a visual thing. You can find it at ntu.org. That's where they've got this new report. Florida, obviously, gaining a lot of people. Tennessee, a state with no income tax, gaining a lot of people. Kind of the interior Mountain West, some low-tax states there. And then you see, like, obviously, New York, Illinois, California, kind of the really big tax states losing people. As you said, this is a trend that's kind of been going on for a while. People have been voting with their feet, but the pandemic seems to have accelerated it.
States like California, for example. California, back in the 2018 version of this report, they lost about $8.8 billion on net. So that's counting people coming in from their tax base. And in 2020, they lost $29 billion. You know, New York lost $8.7 billion in 2018. 2020, that's $24.4 billion. So, like, that's nearly tripling the amount of, and in California's case, I believe it is, tripling the amount of money that is available for their tax base. And that's a problem for California's state budget officials, of course, but it's also a problem for people in California and New York who are now, they're not going to change what they're doing at the state level. They're just going to keep pulling money from the people who are unfortunate enough to stay.
Yeah, and more flexibility, of course, in work arrangements means workers and all of us kind of have more freedom to choose where we want to live, where we want to work, where we want to pay taxes, ultimately. We're talking with Andrew Wolford. He's the Interstate Commerce Initiative Director at the National Taxpayers Union Foundation, talking about this new report looking at migration data from that first year of the pandemic. And now, Andrew, I mean, maybe this is more correlation than it is causation. You know, obviously, we don't know for sure how much of this is driven by the pandemic, I guess, but as people move from state to state, there is kind of this need for states to compete with each other, even more than maybe ever before, about attracting workers and attracting ultimately taxpayers.
And I think that's certainly true, that we can't draw definitive conclusions here, but we can see where the data is pointing, and it's pointing in a clear direction. I think we've seen a lot of states respond About 21 states have cut their income tax rates in recent years, and that's, you know, a direct response to this new reality that taxpayers have a lot more agency in choosing where they want to live and where they want to pay taxes to. So a lot of states are trying to become more competitive. Now, the flip side of that is that some states like California, New York, Illinois, they often choose to respond to these trends by trying to reach into other states and taxpayers who are residents of other states but might have some, you know, very limited connection to their state. So being very aggressive in that manner, that's really something that sort of violates our foundational principles in a lot of ways. But for states that are seeing this like steady leak of taxpayers, especially wealthy taxpayers, to other states, that's how they're choosing to survive.
Not a lot of time left here, Andrew, but quickly, if I'm a state lawmaker in a place that's kind of in the middle here, let's say not an Illinois or a California, but also not a Florida or a Tennessee, one piece of advice, what can I do to make my state more attractive to workers that now have this additional freedom?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty simple. You make your tax code more competitive. I think there has to be a recognition that people who have been facing these high tax burdens for many years, they have more opportunities. And you want your state to be one of those opportunities to get out of these states that refuse to treat their taxpayers as anything other than cash cows.
Yeah, and of course, geography is always relative, right? I mean, I imagine being right next door to a New York or an Illinois probably helps a lot, whereas opposed to being like right next door to Florida probably hurts your cause. So all of that is, of course, a factor here, too. Really fascinating stuff, really interesting data. Folks, I encourage you to check it out, www.ntu.org. You can find their new report on tax migration out of high states. Nobody wants to pay high taxes. I don't want to pay high taxes. We all know that. It's easy to, if you have the opportunity to move around these days, more people are taking advantage. Andrew, that's all the time we have for today, though. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Eric.
And again, that's Andrew Wilford. He is the director of the Interstate Commerce Initiative at the National Taxpayers Union Foundation. Their work, again, online at ntu.org. Check out our work online at reason.com and catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
After three Republican presidential debates, Nikki Haley has emerged as a viable alternative to Donald Trump, should the frontrunner stumble. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA has analysis on this American Radio Journal commentary.
The week before last was a terrible week for the Republican Party nationally, and yet, buried within the stories of electoral defeats and dire warnings about the implications of those defeats for the 2024 presidential election, there were three bits of good news that could be the political salvation of the Republican Party. Attempting to crown winners and losers after the first two televised Republican debates was both risky and inconsequential, and most pundits sidestepped prognostication. But last week's third debate was different. USA Today, The New York Times, Washington Post, The Hill, and Politico all concurred that Nikki Haley had won the third debate. The New York Times opinion section was one of the few major media outlets that did attempt to measure winners and losers in all three debates, and they published an interesting graphic chronicling each candidate's performance on a 10-point scale. On that scale, Nikki Haley won all three debates. Every other candidate had ups and downs. DeSantis rose from fourth in the first to second in the next two debates. The withdrawal of Mike Pence and Tim Scott, two of the most decent and admirable people in politics, further secures both Haley and DeSantis in their respective positions of first and second behind Trump. Christie and Ramaswamy are at the bottom. This has all been well covered, often with a discounting perspective that the debates are of little ultimate relevance, since Donald Trump enjoys a substantial, historically unprecedented, and probably insurmountable lead for the Republican nomination. Two other events that happened last week may be more significant than the debate, and they too advantage Nikki Haley. The first was Monday's release of a New York Times Siena College presidential poll, and the second was Tuesday's off-year election, especially in Virginia, Kentucky, and Ohio. The Times poll stirred up a lot of angst among the commentariat and Democratic Party loyalists because it showed Donald Trump ahead of Joe Biden in five of six battleground states. But buried far down in that poll were some crosstabs that may well turn out to be more significant than the top line showing Trump ahead of Biden. In a theoretical matchup between Nikki Haley and Joe Biden, she was ahead by 8 points overall and in all six battleground states. That's significant. The same poll gave Ron DeSantis a much narrower lead over Biden, 1 point overall and winning four states by small margins and losing two. The most obvious conclusion, even if it's hypothetical this early in the process, is that Haley is a stronger candidate than either Trump or DeSantis. That's good news for Haley and for the GOP. The second event was Tuesday's off-year elections. The always savvy Washington Post political writer Dan Bolz wrote this, "Voters delivered few bright spots for the Republicans and much to worry about. Once again, Democrats outperformed expectations as they did in the 2022 midterm elections. If not a blue wave on Tuesday night, the results reinforced the worries among some Republicans that their brand has become too toxic to too many voters and that whatever weaknesses they see in President Biden, their own problems are acute." Well, that doesn't sound like good news for Republicans, except when you realize that on the top issue that hurt Republicans, abortion, Haley alone staked out a principled position that reaffirmed her own pro-life convictions while articulating a basis for credible cooperation with those who are pro-choice. Again, advantage Haley, and probably good news for the GOP as well, by demonstrating a threading of the needle on this hot topic that other Republicans could adopt. As Heather Higgins argues in a recent column in Real Clear Politics, the GOP needs an empathetic and credible narrative, not just a sound policy. How do these three observations fit together logically? They point in one direction only, in favor of Nikki Haley's candidacy. She's already ahead of DeSantis in New Hampshire, and if she wins there and in South Carolina, as appears likely, DeSantis will be badly damaged by the end of February if he is even still around. So what will it take for her to best the incredibly resilient Donald Trump? I'm convinced that his lead is in much greater jeopardy than current polls and pundits suggest. His legal troubles, revelations that he was more directly involved in encouraging the January 6 uprising than had been known, that his business acumen is both figuratively and literally overvalued, and concerns that a second Trump term would be focused on revenge, paybacks, and authoritarian excess can only result in an eventual cratering of his support. It may not happen until January or even February, but it will happen. And then suddenly the 2024 presidential race will look a lot different than it does now. What then? The sole person on the current horizon who can rescue the Republican Party from self-immolation in 2024 is Nikki Haley. That's not political advocacy, it's political analysis. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, WKANAM in Kankakee, Illinois. Welcome to our new listeners in the land of Lincoln. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our all-new website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.